Jane Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. Hi, and welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show. I'm Jane Lee Grace. I love covering a whole range of different topics on this show, but so much of what we do comes back to mindset. It comes back to how we choose our thoughts, how we put in place the self-esteem, how we become curious about how we can get that sense of self-esteem. And so often the word resilience comes up. I speak a lot about how when people ditch the booze, that's often when they can start to get that sense of feeling a bit more resilient, because it's the resilience that we need, isn't it, to carry us through, so that, you know, when life gets in the way, which let's face it does sometimes, you know, we don't buckle, we don't completely cave in. So I'm really thrilled that my guest is Sally Baker, and I've known of Sally for a long time. She's a well-qualified therapist, coach. She's written several books, and I really wanted to dig into this one on resilience. So I really hope you'll enjoy this interview. Just a word, just to mention that if you are ditching the booze, if that's something that you're currently thinking about, then do check out the Sober Club. It's a community, an online community, where there's an online course called Get the Buzz Without the Booze. There is a whole bunch of resources and information and inspiration within our member portal. I mean, we cover everything to do with all aspects of well-being, including there's a sessions on EFT, there's meditation, there's obviously lots on nutrition, on and on. You mention it, and if it's linked to holistic well-being, it will be in that member portal. And then in addition, we have meetups where we meet online and we do some motivational stuff. And then we meet up in person sometimes as well. Plus, there is a very supportive Facebook community, private community, where we become cheerleaders for each other. So if you're just early stages of ditching the booze, or if you've been sober for years and years and you just want a community and you want that extra support, then do check out the Sober Club. It'd be fantastic to have you part of what we do. We also do one-to-one coaching. That's separate from the community, but do check out the work that that we have there, thesoberclub.com. So I'm really thrilled that today my guest is Sally Baker, who is an award-winning, senior, licensed and accredited full-time therapist based in London. I've known Sally for ages, sort of off and on, but we've never really got to chat, Sally. So it's really good to be able to chat to you. 25 plus years of experience seeing clients for a wide range of complex issues. And I mean, I'm sure we'll get into a lot of this stuff, Sally. But I think one of the things that I was really interested to chat to you about is the fact that you've written several very interesting books, but this latest book, The Getting of Resilience from the Inside Out. Yes. Oh man, resilience, what a word, what an interesting word. Before we get into it though, just tell me a bit about your background. I mean, I know you've been doing this work for a long time, but tell us a bit about your background, because I know that, you know, partly stuff that happened to you always is the reason we do the work we do, isn't it?
Exactly that. So the premise of this book, because it shows up in my work all the time, is that when I was 7, something terrible happened to me. I told my mom and she said, never mention it again. Mm. And from her response, I took it that she was really angry with me and that I'd made a massive mistake. And this was my problem, my guilt, my shame. And it really did change the trajectory of my life for several decades. And it took till I was 35 to have a conversation with my mother that resolved, that touched on that same topic. It was never mentioned till I was 35. Mm. So in my work, I see all the time trauma and horrible things happen to clients. And no amount of therapy will stop horrible things happening. But it's the judgments we make about ourselves, about those events, that seem to be more enduring and more harmful.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And before you became a therapist, what kind of work were you doing, or what was your life like before that time?
I was a journalist and I worked in film. Mm. I worked in visual effects for all the big features that were shot in Europe. We had the biggest blue screens and green screens outside of LA, Hollywood. So I had 20 odd years working in television and film.
Mm. And what made you decide to go into therapeutic work in the end?
Well, I'd been in therapy on and off since I was 14 because of what had happened to me. And I found modalities that really worked that were different from talking therapies. And because it's not enough just to have skin in the game. I mean, lots of therapists now say, oh, yeah, but, you know, I've experienced this and this has happened to me as well. So it adds empathy. But really, I want to show that you can resolve trauma, get clear of past angst and disasters and thrive. So that's the majority. That's why I got into the work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is amazing how people can, you know, I mean, there's this thing of, you know, there's this element of with therapeutic stuff. When we think about years ago, it would have seemed just like, oh, terribly American to have any kind of therapy, wouldn't it? not all that long ago. It's like, oh, how very American.
Well, I mean, Diana's death and, you know, that huge outpouring of shared grief that the country finally kind of unblocked itself somehow, because we'd always had this really stoic British stiff upper lip. So now we're at the point where there's lots of sharing, but there's very few services. So when they say things like, oh, we need a greater awareness of mental health, we have the awareness, but the NHS is on its knees, and it's on its knees with physical issues. It's broken where mental health is concerned.
Yeah, it really is. That's very true. I was talking to somebody just the other day about young people's mental health services, you know, sort of teenagers and young people. And, oh, my God, the waiting list is something like 2 years. And
that's, it is, but when they hit 18, it'll be 5 years.
Yes, so exactly, exactly.
And yeah. COVID is a disaster for young people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God, absolutely. Yeah. So yes, it's much needed. And you're right that, you know, it's these things that the kind of unresolved trauma that we talk about, you know, whether that's trauma with a big T or a little T, it can be all kinds of stuff, can't it? But it can.
It shows up.
Yes, exactly.
Self-sabotage and things like we drink too much or we use drugs or we comfort eat. So, yeah. You know, self-sabotage all the way through our lives.
Absolutely.
It's all those traumas. And you know all about how it shows up with alcohol.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, I was amazed when I first came across the ACE study, you know, the Adverse Childhood Experiences. I was really amazed that that study, it's only something like 10 questions, isn't it? And when I did that study, somebody said to me, oh, do you want, you know, do the study? And at first I thought, well, there's no point in me doing it, really, because although, you know, my upbringing wasn't fabulous, I wasn't abused. So I remember thinking, oh, there's no point in me doing it, because obviously it's going to be about abuse. And thankfully, I wasn't abused. But of course, it's much more innocuous than that. You know, the questions are absolutely. And in fact, I scored 7. You know, my mum had a mental illness and I scored 7. I was like, oh, my goodness. And you know, so that it's a kind of, and then they reckon that if you score something like 3 or more, you have a massively higher percentage of people are going to become addicted one way or another, because you've got all this stuff, you know. And again, you know, the other sort of really big bit of learning for me was when I realised that, okay, but it's not a case of, oh, okay, so that was my childhood experience, so therefore I'll just blame the parents. you know, it's their fault. You know, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. And the good news is, you know, we can move on. That's the fantastic news.
Isn't it is so. The best news possible, because ideally in childhood, you're raised in a family where you're loved, honored, and adored, and there aren't addictions or mental health issues, so the parents are really attentive and there for you. But I never see those people.
No, exactly.
They're out there. I know they're out there.
Yeah, yeah.
They're having a big life and they're having a great time and they do not come to see me. So I see people who were raised in conditions that weren't ideal for them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be violent abuse and violent sexual abuse. There's a whole plethora of ways of not meeting a child's needs.
No, exactly.
Moms can do that with a raised eyebrow. They can do that with a look. They can put you down. You can learn from a very early age that if you don't meet criteria laid down, then you're not acceptable. Everything's good. And I see those people.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, you know, it can be those little things. It can be that, you know, that parent who didn't acknowledge that drawing that you thought was fabulous, or it can be something very small, because it's not always about the thing. it's what you made it mean, isn't it? You know, and that's what we carry through into our adulthood without even realizing what the hell it is. We just know we're unsettled.
But the number of fathers that leave when the daughter hits around puberty, the girl's coming into her own self, and then suddenly the father has rejected, she feels that her father has rejected her. And I see those people all the time, you know, when they hit 30, 40, 50, and they've been carrying around that pain for a long time.
Yeah. And often patterns repeat, don't they? I mean, in my own case, I know that I was absolutely, you know, now looking back, I can see that I was desperate for a father figure. And that's what sort of showed up in one of my first relationships. And then I stayed way too long, you know, way too long.
So I take a lot of clients through their dating experience, and I talk to them about, but your picker is broken. You need to like reset, have a break, because you just keep picking the same bloke.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's medicine for modern living. A people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world. And hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And I mean, on that note, in terms of relationships, it really does come down to being able to accept yourself first, doesn't it? I mean, love yourself is perhaps too strong an expression, but until we've got that piece, it it's easy to look back, isn't it? But I can see that all I was trying to do was fix myself. You know, I needed to be fixed. I needed someone to support me. I needed, you know, some security, and I needed a father. And looking back, you know, I can see that in one relationship, I was really unhappy. I mean, unbelievably unhappy, but stuck.
Very vulnerable.
Very vulnerable and literally stuck, because that is what seemed like my security. You see it all the time. It's it is really fascinating how sometimes these early traumas and sometimes even very seemingly small ones can impact on so many layers of our life.
Self-esteem, self-belief, how one values himself. So if we all have a voice in our head, you know, that runs a commentary on everything we say and do, the people who were raised in families where love was conditional they often have a very critical voice in their head.
Yeah.
So they don't, I know some people have cheerleaders on their shoulder going, yeah, but you're still fabulous. Again, I don't see those people. I see the ones with the carping critical voice in their head that forever puts them down, makes them feel small.
Yeah, it's really true. And what I think is really interesting, what I've discovered in the last few years, you know, since I've been running the Sober Club, I've found that I've been absolutely amazed, actually, at the impact that parents have, even when we're in our later years. And, you know,
Unfortunately, absolutely.
And I find it incredible. I've had, there's been lots of people who've reached out to me and said, you know, I've stopped drinking, or I'm early weeks and ditching the booze. I'm doing really well. But my mother, you know, is insistent that I have a drink when I go and visit her, or, you know, or my father is, and it's just so bizarre. Clearly it's their stuff. It's not yours to carry, but really powerful things. And I know you've written a book on a couple of books around emotional eating and our relationship with food. And there's another one where parents, oh my God, the impact is ridiculous. I had one woman that I was working with, and her mother was asking her to step on the scales weekly. Her mother was about 80. And she was asking this woman to step on the scales. I mean, oh God, what is that about? That we remain children. Yeah, we remain children in that relationship. And yet clearly the whole weight thing was her mother's to carry. It was not hers to carry. But so difficult, isn't it, to be able to set those boundaries, you know, even when we're grown up.
Teach women to say no is something we have to learn as adults, because we're raised to be really compliant.
Yes.
And women are fearful about saying no or putting down boundaries with friends or with family. But sometimes I have to really encourage clients to step away from their families. I mean, calling their family for abuse, you know, verbal abuse every Saturday, their one big day off they've got, or Sunday.
Yes.
And I say, look, we need to drop this. We need to change this pattern, because this just allows the inner child in you, the little girl or the little boy in you, to continue to be abused and put down.
Mm. Yeah, so true.
Boundaries are a real problem, a difficult thing.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, I used to think, when I was still drinking, I used to think that anyone who sort of had boundaries was just really mean. Because I didn't have any. And I just, people who said, no, I can't make that day. It's like, oh, you're so mean. You know, I now realize it's absolutely essential. It really is.
It's like a muscle.
Time
today, start small. No, I don't want another cup of tea. No, I don't want to go there. No, I don't want to do this. But build up like a muscle.
Yeah.
Make it stronger and stronger. Then you can say no to really big things and feel
like that. And I love that phrase, no is a complete sentence. Because it really can be, can't it? Tell me more about resilience then. Tell me how you sort of introduce the topic.
Right. Okay. So it's interesting, because people assume that everyone has resilience, but really they don't. So my book is aimed at adults who had the less than perfect childhood, like most of us did, and the techniques that they need to learn incrementally to put in place to develop resilience in later life. So that's like looking at their self-belief, looking at their timeline of what happened to them and how they feel about the stuff that happened to them. Mm. And then teaching them very simple techniques like EFT, the weird tapping thing.
Yeah.
Great. So I'm an advanced practitioner in tapping. I've used tapping for over 25 years. I really like it. So I always start with tapping then with clients, because they can take it away, learn it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is great. It frees them up from therapy forever. You know, and just to explore what happened to them, the conclusions they came to and the judgments they made about themselves, and unpick those, because they probably don't serve you.
Mm. So, you know, I know it's a sort of a slightly odd question, but what is resilience? Why do we need it? I mean, people have a different perception of what they think resilience is. So, you know, we might call resilience, you know, a stiff upper lip and the kind of person that will just keep on keeping on. And there might be an element of that we might think, well, actually, I don't really want to be like that. I want to be able to be more open and gentle or whatever. So tell me a couple of the different facets of resilience.
You're right, because it's a complex term. I mean, I read about it the other day, the oil industry needs to be more resilient. I think, God, blimey, resilience just shows up everywhere. So resilience in people, kind of an inner belief that you're okay, and an inner belief that you can have an impact on the world, because the people formulate ideas about themselves when they're powerless children and they feel that they can't impact the world. It's called an external locus of control. And that means that you just get buffeted by events. So that idea of the external locus of control, I show clients, teach clients, and in the book, techniques to bring that external locus of control to the internal, to the core of you, where you begin to recognize and acknowledge your own self-worth. So resilience is about recognizing self-worth, having a strong intuition, which is the first casualty of a not less than perfect childhood. So teaching people how to have hunches and gut reactions and recognizing them, so that we don't get into situations where, I don't know how this happened to me, but I got into this terrible situation. Stuff goes on all the time. Looking at patterns so that people can unpick patterns. But it's mainly around unpicking the judgments, because people have a set of often negative judgments about themselves.
Yeah.
Pick those. Then you can start to value yourself more, recognize your self-esteem and your uniqueness, and take better care of you. Like, treat yourself with self-compassion.
Yeah, those limiting beliefs, I mean, they're a big one, aren't they? That voice in the head, you know, that tells you you're not good enough, you're not as good as everyone else, you're weak, you'll never be able to stop drinking or stop eating the wrong foods, or on and on and on, those goddamn voices. We all have those voices, don't we? We all have that inner critic voice.
Yes.
But it's, I suppose... Exactly, and finding a way of taming it rather than allowing it to kick off.
Yeah, so the first step with the inner voice is to recognise what it's saying to you, because it's like a toxic drip, just sort of below conscious awareness, and it's having free rein of your subconscious mind without you even registering it. So drawing someone's attention to it and getting them to note down, even on their phone, the key expressions, the idiom, the accent it might be said in. So let's identify where it comes from, and then people can recognize, oh my God, that voice in my head isn't even my voice. It's someone else's voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's a range of techniques, but I really like the game show noise one. I get whole families to do this. So when a negative thought comes in, if they're on their own, they can go out loud, it's a BS thought. Like, BS thought again. Or if they start talking to their family or their kids start talking to them saying, oh, it's going to be another terrible day today. That's a BS thought. So then I've got all the adults and the other kids in the family going, you just said a BS thought.
Yeah.
They need to be interrupted. You need to be and then ultimately changing that voice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we focus on, we get more of, right? So if we constantly focus on the doom and the gloom and all the rest of it, and I do think that there is, I sound like my own old maiden aunt, you know, but sort of social media stuff, and the more time we spend online doom scrolling, the worse this is, right? And you know, I always say to people now, even if you haven't got a whole morning practice, it'd be lovely if you had, but even if you don't have that, at least don't go on your phone when you first wake up, because it's just disastrous, isn't it? You know, you got your phone waking you up, and then you go straight to your phone, and the very first thing you see before you've even checked in with how you are, you know, before you've checked anything, before you've even given yourself the slightest, you know, good morning hug, as it were, you open a message and there's something kicking off. There's not even anything to do with you. And I do think that's a really big problem, the whole doom scrolling. It is a habit. You're absolutely right.
And the figures are out now on social media about, especially with younger people, how much time they spend on social media. It's a direct correlation to their mental well-being. And it's like comparison and compare thing.
Yeah, comparison is the thief of joy, as they say. Yeah.
And people aren't realising that those photographs can take a week to curate for 125th of a second that's then, you know, made into a photograph. And ordinary people are just comparing their lives to something that is impossible to match.
Yeah. So would you say then that, you know, in all the years you've obviously been doing this work for a long time, have you seen a change in, well, the number of people that require support, and have you seen a definite increase in issues that you might even equate to social media use? Would you say it's a direct correlation?
I'm seeing more and more young people post-COVID. The youngest I work with is 11 because I need them to have with the work that I do, because I don't do play therapy and stuff, they need to have a level of competence around their own thought processes. But 11, but I'm seeing young people who've been really damaged by social media. I had a client outside of Sydney and he had clicked on a link and he saw a man shooting himself in the head.
Wow.
At 11, and he
God's
had
sake.
traumatic stress, so he
Yeah.
couldn't sleep anymore. He stopped eating. His mood completely changed, and his mom got hold of me. And he was a brilliant boy, and he really kind of ran with the work. And he's fine now. But also, the youngest girl that I've just heard about now in Los Angeles at 11, sending a topless picture of herself because she'd been groomed by other people in her group,
Yeah.
and the fallout at her school for this dreadful experience. So our children, I don't see social media and I don't see tech at home as a benign influence. I just
Yeah.
don't see it constantly as a really disruptive, it's not a good thing. And parents need to sort of get to grips with this now.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I find really worrying is the amount of young women on antidepressants.
Yes. For years now as well. Yeah, but back in the day, antidepressants were hard to get. And if you got them from your doctor, that he'd say, well, you can stay on them for 6 months, or we're going to severely, heavily review all this. I have clients now who've been on antidepressants for 17
Yeah,
years.
me too. I was stunned when I first started doing coaching work with women who were drinking too much. I was absolutely amazed at the number who'd been given antidepressants. Often it would be because, you know, they'd rock up to a GP with menopausal symptoms, anxiety, mood swings, whatever, and they'd come away with antidepressants or HRT or sometimes both. And they were never asked about their drinking. So some of these women were downing a bottle of wine a night. And then as you say, nothing got reviewed.
Nothing gets
So
reviewed.
I mean, that's very bizarre.
It is. Well, I see a lot of clients about their alcohol consumption, and no one ever comes to me and says, you know what, I'm drinking too much.
Yeah,
So how it goes is they come and say, I have insomnia, or I have
exactly.
really heightened social anxiety, or I'm really paranoid. And I say, okay, so we start to look at that. And then I say, so just tell me background information, tell me what's happened with you around alcohol.
Yeah.
And every to a man and a woman, they all say, oh, nothing wrong with alcohol. It's completely normal consumption.
Yeah.
I only drink at the weekend. I say, okay, so when does your weekend start? I say a Thursday. And when does it end? It's a Tuesday. And then I say, okay, so when was alcohol consumption really normal? When was the last time you blacked out? And they say, oh God, I've not blacked out for at least a week.
Yeah. But you
Everyone
see,
normalize their
I
consumption.
know. You see, doctors don't, most GPs don't, you know, that if you rock up to a regular GP for a health issue, in inverted commas, they don't take that into account. In
Well,
fact, even if you do tell a GP that you are worried about your drinking, you know, what I was told was, well, you seem completely normal. So that kept me stuck for another 5 years.
The station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad,
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It's very interesting how, well, everything's connected. It has to be that holistic picture, doesn't it? We really do have to look at the holistic picture.
The alcohol puts women at risk when they're dating and all that goes on. Waking up in beds in hotels that they don't recognise and all the rest of it. I've had clients who've had that experience. You can't have strong mental well-being when that's part of the mix.
Absolutely. Tell me a bit more about when you talk about resilience. What would you like to see happen earlier? Like, you know, how could we support children to have more resilience, before all of this kicks in? What could we do?
We've got to give them unconditional positive regard and love them whether they succeed or fail. Really authentic and genuine. We say, oh, it doesn't matter that you didn't do very well in that test, or you're not going to get into that school. It doesn't matter because we still love you. I still love you. And parents are actually, you know, that part of the helicopter parenting is having inflated goals for your children.
Yeah.
Where you really want them to hyperachieve. And that's not helpful for kids that don't feel as though they are achieving.
I also think, I mean, I guess you would agree that, you know, one of the issues as well is that we don't sort of learn any emotional resilience in the sense, you know, in schools and stuff, in the sense that we're not allowed our emotions. Most children are not allowed their emotions, are they? It's a case of, oh, you're really at, you know, you've been naughty, go and sit on the naughty step. Oh, you're upset, have a sweet. That should sort it out. So when, you know, I think this is one of the interesting things when people do start to look to their personal growth or whatever, when they stop drinking, for example, they have to feel the feels. And sometimes they haven't actually felt them since they were children, and even then probably not very much. So literally, if you start drinking when you're in your teens, sure, all the big stuff, all the stuff, all the important things in your life, whether happy or sad, you know, or the first time you have sex, or everything is under the haze of booze.
True.
So when that's taken away, and you might be in your 50s, it's like, oh God, how do I handle basic stuff? Like, I've just had a phone call that's really upset me. I actually don't know what to do with myself. How do I handle grief? How do I handle even celebration? Because you've done everything through the lens of having a glass in your hand. And surely there needs to be a way of encouraging us to, I don't know, just kind of strengthen those emotional muscles when we're children. We need to allow children to have all those feelings. You know, sometimes we're angry. It's okay.
Yeah, but it goes through now to young adults who feel that they have to be positive all of the time. So we get into this framework of toxic positivity where you can only be positive. But actually, while you're trying to always be happy or trying to always be positive, that means that you're very afraid of going anywhere less than positive. But while we're afraid of our emotions, they're going to haunt us and they're going to catch us out. We need to be able to embrace all of our emotions and have the resilience and the trust that we can feel sad, we can feel overwhelmed, and we're going to cut. They are just feelings, they are just thoughts, and we can come through them. We can't hold them at arm's distance because it's exhausting and it's not authentic. So we have to embrace all of them, let them wash over us.
Yeah.
See that the world still turns, we're still okay, and we can go forward.
And that is that resilience piece, isn't it? Knowing that, this too will pass and that we'll be okay again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. So just tell us a little bit about the book, because obviously you share your story in there, but it's very much a kind of a practical book that has some actionable steps.
It's got 12 actionable steps that you can do, like one a week over the 12 weeks, where you can, and it's and they're kind of incremental, so they get, it's a pathway, it's a route through, and they're easy to do and they're fun to do, to build, to just firstly to recognize where you're at, a bit like the voice in your head, recognize what's happening, and then the steps, incremental steps to make changes, how you think and feel about yourself, because they're probably decisions that you're making now that you've never really fully embraced and made before. So it's an opportunity to have a big reset and feel differently about yourself.
I know one thing you talk about is breaking free from self-sabotaging habits. That's a really big one for lots of people in my community, and I really recognize it, because I absolutely remember how it used to be for me. I'd get on a path of whatever it was, whatever habit I wanted to change, being a bit healthier, stopping drinking for a while, whatever it was. But then it was literally as though, I suppose I saw it as a kind of rebellion, that kind of self-sabotage, well, sod it, okay, so I've made that decision, but you know what, I can do, and absolutely ridiculous, completely inverted. Really, if I cared enough about myself, I'd recognize that, drinking again would be self-harming. So actually, it's not an act of badass rebellion at all.
No. But it's so fascinating. I often see addiction switch as well.
Cross addictions, you mean?
They see lots of women who'd had gastric band surgery and they've gone privately for it. So, because the hoops at the NHS put in the place of women for bariatric surgery were so high.
Yes.
You go abroad and get it for about $8,000. Anyway, so they would go abroad, they'd have no counselling, nothing at all, come back, now they would have a bypass. I don't think they do gastric bands so much anymore. But they would then switch to alcohol.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's very common. So if the addiction behaviour is driven by trauma,
yeah,
go back and clear the trauma.
Yeah, absolutely.
Masking the pain. Everything else is a coping strategy. Overeating, restricted eating, all of those things, alcohol, class A drugs, they're all, or also compulsive shopping, those kind of behaviours.
Yes.
All strategies for survival. Yeah. That we put together in times when we didn't have any other strategies to call on. They don't serve us, but they allow us to manage the trauma.
If
trauma can be cleared and resolved and let go of, then you can be up and free of all self-sabotaging behaviours.
Absolutely. Fantastic. I love it, Sally. Well, thank you so much for putting all this in a book. What fabulous value, really is. And so do you want to just give us your website, and we'll put the link and everything in the show notes as well.
Great. So sally@workingonthebody.com is my email, and the website is workingonthebody.com.
Brilliant. Sally, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.